Many of an age not unadjacent to mine may fondly recall those futuristic puppet series of 1950s and 60s vintage, where our childhood daydreams of space travel, underwater exploration, and technical wizardry were given life through our string-powered wooden heroes. I was fascinated by the likes of Thunderbirds, in which Jeff Tracy directed operations from Tracy Island and communicated with his intrepid sons manning Thunderbirds 1-5 from the deepest ocean to outer space by way of Videolink. Videolink. Speech and vision over vast distances. Fantastic. Unbelievable. Such is the march of progress, eh? By the time I'd reached middle age, Videolink technology, once the illusory provocateur of a children's television series, now came as bog standard on my home computer. And yet I barely used it. Not blasé or indifferent, I was keen to, but more of a common notion that despite all this newfangled stuff, you can't beat meeting face to face. There's nothing like a pandemic to fracture complacency. And the COVID-19 scourge, with all that has entailed for social distancing and group gatherings, has not too subtly caused us to completely reevaluate that one. Sales of video conferencing packages have hit stratospheric levels, and it's now the norm across the board, from virtual meetings of family and friends through to corporate undertakings, presentations, lectures, concerts and broadcasting, home teaching, the whole gamut. And I suspect that, having been nudged across the cyberspace of Rubicon, we will not be reverting any time soon. Me? I welcome it, if only for very practical reasons of time and sheer cost. Until shortly before BC, that's before coronavirus, I was routinely undertaking a 7-hour round trip by car, together with the accompanying fuel bills, in appalling traffic congestion, and all to offer a meeting little more face-to-face than it's in my report. Lunacy, of which no more. Video it is. Which brings me to some of the ticks, foibles and protocols that have already sprung up around the video conference phenomenon, where, by its nature, one is looking at a fellow contributor, or plural, set against a backdrop of their personal environment. And how many of those settings I've noticed are shelves of books? Artificially contrived for the occasion? Who knows? It's not just me who suspects. The various radio shows I frequent around the dial now routinely make a point of commenting to the listener how their fellows, whom we of course cannot see, are surrounded by books. Whether or not they are, it's all knockabout stuff with sardonic undertones of scholarly pretentiousness. Yet here, notwithstanding the welcome levity, is where I profoundly disagree with the implication that to own and show books is an ostentation, an attempt at trying to look clever. I believe a good book to be the counterpart of a good friend. You may not have been acquainted very long, you may not know them very well, you may not wish to be at their side all of the while. But when you are together, your life is enriched. You wouldn't abuse your friend, you don't deface a book. You don't conceal your friends through awkwardness, you openly display your books without prejudice. And, perhaps most significantly, you may never get to learn all there is to know about your friend, in the same way that it is no shame to admit there are books you have never finished reading. But you're nonetheless moved by them, to the extent that you embrace them as part of your comfort zone. I'll now lay a small wager that one of the sharper examples of the latter in recent years will be Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. First published in 1988, it has sold over 25 million copies to date and looks impressive on any bookshelf. Yet I question how many of its purchasers have read it for any distance beyond the first few pages. Why this is a germane exemplar lies in my confession that not only have I not read it, I haven't even bought it, but I will. It is, to extend my analogy, a future friend I just haven't met yet. I don't know how well I'll come to know it, but presumably, much like the 25 million who have gone before me, I would value its acquaintance. One particular book that did come my way recently, as a gift from my other half, caused me to make the comparison with Hawking. Weighing in at just shy of 400 pages, it was destined to keep me occupied for a while. So, After a couple of deep breaths, I decided to put all the other partial reads to one side and give it a go. I'm glad I did, and the opportunity afforded by enforced time alone enabled me to devour it voraciously. There may not be too many good things to come out of lockdown, but this was up there. How the World Thinks by Julian Baggini is one of those rare tomes that goes way beyond the norm in fundamentally refocusing one's perspectives. Now, I do hope that doesn't sound hyperbole. Perhaps it may be less flamboyant to instead say it has channeled, crowbarred my thoughts into new realms of understanding. I've alluded to Baggini elsewhere in my deliberations, and on the strength of this, I will likely do so again. Dr. Julian Baggini is Academic Director of the Royal Institute of Philosophy, the author of several other books, and a regular correspondent for national magazines, periodicals, and think tanks. Notwithstanding his evident intellect, the appeal of How the World Thinks is its sheer accessibility, aided considerably by an elegant syntax that hits the minimalist bullseye with a combination of unerring accuracy and graceful efficiency. Take this, for example, in his digest of part one. "I hope," he says, "that it is now obvious why I have started this book by asking how the world knows. It might at first look an abstract question, but if we want to understand how the world thinks, it is fundamental. It helps one to be better prepared to understand ideas about how the world is." Gosh, I wish I'd written that. One section that especially caught my eye, which doesn't really narrow it down because they all did, is Baggini's exposition on time. Hawking examined time too, but Hawking was a scientist, Baggini is a philosopher. Entire volumes have been given to explaining the distinction, so forgive my condescending clumsiness in thinking I can do so in one sentence, but here goes. Philosophy is the quest for knowledge by logical thought in questioning the nature of the universe. Science is the establishing of facts by data-driven observation. Hawking's conclusions? Take another look at his book. There's 25 million out there somewhere that will give the lowdown on his empiricism. And Baggini? Well, he explores the quite mind-expanding distinction between linear and circular time. The what? In Christian society, we're accustomed to thinking of time in a straight line, specifically yesterday, today, and tomorrow. This is reinforced by a religious doctrine of life itself along a course from birth through the now until our eventual death. Now, we've considered this as a default for our faith in progress lying in the forward direction since the age of the Enlightenment. Conversely, some cultures, notably those who rely on oral tales and folklore as evidence of identity, believe their history goes full circle and must be passed on through the generations for its sense of place to survive. In direct contradiction to the Book of Revelation that describes Jesus as Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last, Alpha and Omega are at one and the same point. The beginning is the end. The first is the last. The circle may not retain the same dimension, but may expand as time progresses through successive generations. In some Middle East paradigms, there is a hybrid of the linear and cyclical. Islamic conceptions of time are as cycles based on appearances of prophets, but which develop linearly by moving humanity forward towards the ultimate revelation signified by the Judgment Day events associated with the appearance of the Mahdi. In Chinese cyclical thought, wisdom and truth are timeless, and we do not need so much to go forward as to hold on to that we already have. Confucius believed that his purpose was not to announce any new truths or initiate any new economy, but was to prevent that which is already known from being lost. While such divergences from our concept of linear time may be difficult to grasp, they are a prerequisite to us understanding the likes of Maori ethos and Aboriginal dreamtime. Most of us would be hard-pushed to identify our own metaphysical framework, that is, our personal understanding of the structure of nature, but we all have one, and without realizing it, unconsciously base our assumptions and values on tenets that have been instilled in us generationally. And, as Beghini suggests, it is bringing these assumptions to the surface that we may also better understand how other peoples, not of our persuasion, see the world and why they see it that way. It is, as he concludes with commendable clarity, sometimes simply by changing the frame, the whole picture can look very different. Now, let us cut to the chase. Does that not sound like an elucidation of the root cause of centuries of war and conflict across the globe? And does it not also offer a pragmatic contemporary roadmap towards a resolution in just about every one being played out right now? It certainly did for the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was founded on a conciliatory recognition of widely divergent standpoints following the collapse of apartheid. There's a thoughtful scene in an otherwise grim psychological murder movie, Seven, released in 1995, and starring Brad Pitt alongside Morgan Freeman, where Freeman is researching late at night in a library. He notices a group of night security personnel idling and queries why, surrounded by a world of knowledge at their fingertips, they choose to play cards. A quarter of a century later, when they might instead be video chatting with their mates, let's hazard a guess at where they'll position the laptop camera. Apropos my earlier rebuttal of the implication that to own and show books is an ostentation, an attempt at trying to look clever, I'm willing to concede exceptions. The demise of the printed word has been predicted almost from the day that William Caxton's press ground into life in the late 15th century. Yet, despite our monumental technical advancements since then, books are still around in some abundance. Notably, it now seems, on video links. Long may it continue, if only for me envisaging certain conceptual difficulties in making friends with a hard drive.